Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Today's program is from our Take Note archives. Lisa Genova was selling her debut novel, Still Alice, from the trunk of her car before she landed a publisher. Her book, about a college professor suffering from early-onset Alzheimer's disease, has since been adapted for the big screen. Julianne Moore plays Alice, and she's been nominated for an Oscar. Here's our 2011 conversation with author Lisa Genova. Lisa Genova, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You refer to yourself as a Harvard-trained neuroscientist, a Meisner-trained actress, and an entirely untrained writer, and yet that didn't stop you from publishing two bestsellers.
It's a little tongue-in-cheek, but right. I took one English class my freshman year in college, and I had no conscious ambition to become a writer, certainly not a novelist. I was a neuroscientist primarily. Training as an actress came while I was writing the novel, because I figured while I'm being a novelist, I might as well just keep going.
But you said that turned out to be the best writing class you ever could have taken,
yeah.
The acting.
So I stayed away from the writers' groups and the writing classes while I was writing Still Alice. I was reading a lot on craft. I was reading great books like On Writing by Stephen King and Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg, really good books that helped me learn how to write. And I was paying attention as I was reading other stories as well. But I was afraid of being among people who would sort of maybe well-intentioned bully me into writing their version of my story because I just didn't know what I was doing, really. But the acting, it turns out all of the principles I was learning in acting applied beautifully to writing. Things like you're always telling the truth under imaginary circumstances.
This moment-to-moment spontaneity.
Yeah, exactly. The emotional spontaneity that's really hard for us socialized grown-ups to express. You learn how to do that as an actor. And then I would go home and write and I would find I could be emotionally honest on the page.
And that's probably what readers have most often said about Still Alice, is that it is emotionally real, heartbreakingly real.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that was the goal. My grandmother had Alzheimer's, and I read everything I could find about Alzheimer's to try to help educate primarily my aunts who were taking care of her. And everything I read was written from the point of view of the outside looking in. Everything was written by a caregiver or a clinician or a scientist. And so this sort of, what does it feel like to have it, was missing. And so that's really what I wanted to try to portray, was what does it feel like to have it from the perspective of the person who has it.
And of course, the person in Still Alice who has it is Alice Holland, who is 50 years old. She's got the life by the horns.
Yeah.
She's a psychology and linguistics professor at Harvard with three children, a successful husband, and things start to slip. She goes for a run on a route that she's taken many, many times and suddenly finds herself in Harvard Square not knowing exactly where she is.
Right. And so originally the symptoms, you know, there's kind of a fine line between normal forgetting and forgetting that isn't normal. You know, we all walk into the room and say, oh my God, why did I come in here? Or where did I put my keys? But it can start to shift. The forgetting can become more frequent and it can become different. So like with forgetting the keys, I tell people, you know, if you can't find your keys and you find them on the hall table or you find them in your coat pocket, you're fine. If you find them in the refrigerator or if you find them and think, what are these for? That's the shift that can happen. So with Alice, the forgetting seemed normal at first, like forgetting her BlackBerry and not remembering her to-do list. But the getting lost in the neighborhood close to home, that was, oh my God, something's going on. And maybe it's not just I'm too busy, or maybe it's not just maybe I'm not getting enough sleep. Maybe it's not a symptom of menopause. And in fact, it was Alzheimer's.
Now, your grandmother was 85 when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Why did you choose to focus on early onset Alzheimer's, the less common? There are 5.4 million Americans with Alzheimer's and just a half a million or so with early onset.
Right. So a couple of reasons. So my grandmother, who had Alzheimer's in her 80s, we missed the beginning stages of her Alzheimer's altogether because I think, like a lot of families, we assumed that my grandmother's forgetting was a normal part of normal aging. And she, too, expected to become more and more forgetful as she aged, so she didn't bring what was going on to our attention either. So by the time we as a family really understood what we were dealing with, we missed all of those early stages, those first moments, what the beginning of Alzheimer's looks like. So I thought, well, you know, there are these 10% of people with Alzheimer's who are much younger who would very much be sensitive to those beginning stages and not think, well, this is a normal part of being 50. And I also wanted to give a face and a voice to those people who aren't included in what typically gets talked about when people talk about Alzheimer's. I think, you know, the general public, we tend to skip to, if you imagine what it looks like, what is Alzheimer's, you tend to skip to end stage, someone who's quite elderly, someone who's dying from Alzheimer's. Well, what does living with Alzheimer's look like? I wanted to give a face and a voice to that group of people who aren't included.
And I'm kind of wondering where that all came from, because you said you trained as a neuroscientist at Harvard. You're married. You have one child. It's 2003. You divorce.
Yes.
And suddenly, this person who's been working as a strategy consultant in the healthcare industry says, you know what? I'm not going back to that. I'm going to do something completely different. I've taken one writing class, as you said, and I want to be a writer. I mean, I kind of think, where does that come from?
Yeah. Oh, well, I hadn't even taken a writing class. I'd taken an English
class. In high school.
Class,
I mean,
like,
in college.
Back when I was 18. It was, you know, I actually, part of it was the divorce. It was so life-changing for me, so unexpected, so heartbreaking. And it really did sort of shake everything up. And I started asking myself some questions like, okay, you know, what do I want my life to look like now? And I had planned to go back to that job as a strategy consultant. I was a divorced single mom. Like, that was the responsible thing to do, and I was good at it and paid well, and that's where I should have gone. And that was the plan. But then the questions kept coming, and it was like, well, hold on a second. Why do I have to go back to that, to my job that I had before my daughter was born? If I could do anything I wanted, what would that be? My answer, which was really exciting and really terrifying, was write the novel. So I did. I dropped my daughter off at preschool, and instead of going to my responsible job, I went to the Starbucks near my house and began writing Still Alice.
And so how did you support yourself in that period? Because it was actually 2003 you started this. It took you a year and a half to write it,
yeah.
And it wasn't self-published until 2007.
Yeah. Well, so in the beginning, it was in the divorce, we split up assets, and I had a nest egg, and I knew I could live for a while and comfortably, and it would be okay. I wasn't saving any money, but it, you know, we weren't going to be out on the street. And then a few things happened. I started dating again, and I got remarried, and we moved to Cape Cod, and by the time I moved there, I self-published the book shortly after that.
Which is an interesting story, too. So you take this book that you've written out of some passion that came from, you know, deep within, and you can't find a publisher. You send 100 letters or more to literary agents, and what do they say to you?
Yeah, so it's funny. I'm still finding the rejection letters. So I did what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to send out query letters to literary agents, and I got the big Bible of a book, the Literary Marketplace, that lists all of these agents. And I did. I sent out 100 query letters, and I'm still waiting to hear back from some of them. I mostly heard back no in the form of a standard form rejection letter, dear author, no thank you. And those are the little slips of paper I'm still finding tucked away in books today in my office, or I'll go to clean out a folder, and I found 19 of them a few weeks ago, and I thought I'd thrown them all away years ago. So you wait, and I'm pretty impatient, and so this was a difficult time for me. The book I felt was done. I was waiting to hear from someone who might represent it, who could then take it to a publishing house. And so about 9 months into waiting, I heard back from 4 agents who wanted to read the manuscript. One I'm still waiting to hear back from. 2 said, Alzheimer's, I think it's just there's not an audience out there who's going to be willing to read about Alzheimer's. It's too depressing. And then the last one just couldn't wrap his brain around the fact that I've got this PhD in neuroscience from Harvard. He's like, what are you doing writing a novel? You should be writing nonfiction.
Fiction, right.
Write a nonfiction book about Alzheimer's and then get back to me. But at this point, I had remarried, moved to Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and there are no biotechnology, neuroscience, lab, pharmaceutical, anything on Cape Cod. So I'm like,
you had to make
this
work.
I'm hoping to make it work somehow. So without really any other choice, because I didn't want to self-publish. But I did. In the summer of 2007, I self-published.
You self-published. You spent $450. You went to a company called iUniverse.
Yes.
And you sold this out of the back of your car. Maybe by the end, by the time it sold at auction to Simon & Schuster, maybe 1,000 copies. How many copies have sold since then?
I don't exactly know. I know that there are over 1 million copies in print in the U.S. and over 1 million copies have sold worldwide. It's been translated into, I think, 27 languages now.
And what it really says is people weren't looking for nonfiction.
Right.
They're really learning about Alzheimer's through fiction.
So, you know, Alzheimer's is this, you know, people are afraid of it. It reminds me of what cancer was like 40, 50 years ago, where we couldn't even say the word. People called it the big C. People are afraid to talk about Alzheimer's, but it's affecting, you just said, 5.4 million Americans have it. And those 5.4 million people have people who love them. So this is affecting a lot of people, and everybody's afraid to talk about it. But we need to understand it, and we want to understand it. And we want to stay connected to our loved ones as much as we can as they're slipping away. And how do we do that? Well, reading nonfiction is homework. It's hard work. It's dry, and it's facts and bullet points. But if I can read a story and learn through that, you know, stories are what sort of move us and entertain us. And in the meanwhile, while we're reading a story that entertains, hopefully we're maybe learning a little something about this disease that's so scary.
You actually worked with the National Alzheimer's Association on developing a discussion guide.
Yeah, it's definitely popular. Well, you know, again, there are still people out there who are afraid to read it. And I hear a lot from book clubs where people are like, well, we picked it, but we had a couple people who were like, I can't read it, I'm afraid. And they usually get roped in and are appreciative and glad that they did. In the Alzheimer's community, it's been a really positive experience. It's giving people sort of a platform or a vehicle for discussing these issues that can be really difficult to sort of raise your hand and say, I have a question about. They can say, well, when Alice went through this or when her husband and children had this conversation, it reminded me of what I went through, and it gets the conversation started.
You mentioned fear, and there is one theory that Alzheimer's, like mad cow disease, could actually be contagious.
Oh, gosh, no. Well, I actually wasn't aware of that. No, it's not contagious, but people feel, you know, people are awkward around mental illness or diseases of the brain. It's I think, so scary for people, this idea of losing yourself, right? So heart disease affects your heart, you know, your kidney, your liver, your bones, your skin, but that's your body. Your brain is this,
it's
wrapped in with your spirit and your mind and your personality, and it's terrifying to the thought of losing that.
There is a genetic component to Alzheimer's. Is it something you worry about because your grandmother had Alzheimer's?
I don't. So this sort of autosomal dominant, if your parent has the gene, they will get Alzheimer's, and then you have a 50% chance of inheriting the gene that will cause Alzheimer's, is only in familial Alzheimer's. And familial Alzheimer's is a form of early onset. So you'd see it with your grandparents and an uncle and an aunt and a cousin, but they're getting it in their 50s or their 40s or their early 60s. And it really runs in the family. Then you would be concerned and want to probably talk to a genetic counselor if you want to see if you've got the gene that will cause it. For most people, for most of Alzheimer's, it's a combination of environmental and genetic influences on your gene expression that will then lead to sort of funnel down to that one hit that can be caused in the young onset familial cases. But so my grandmother was 85, and she probably had a bunch of environmental and genetic causes of her Alzheimer's. So
no sleepless nights over that.
I don't worry about that.
No, you mentioned going to Australia and to England and to all kinds of places. So worldwide, people have been captivated by the story. The equivalent, I guess, of Oprah, the Oprah Book Club, Richard and Judy picked up your book and said, this is one to read. How did that change your life?
Well, it's been a whirlwind for sure. As you said, I was not long ago selling them out of the trunk of my car. So I am very appreciative and grateful for where all of this has taken me. And more than that, appreciative of where the story has touched so many people. When I was doing the research for the book, and I came to know so many people who have Alzheimer's, I realized I had an opportunity and a responsibility to tell this story well so that it would really help people with this missing information and this missing connection of what does it feel like to have it.
In fact, you approached this book as a scientist. You talked with physicians who are working with patients with early onset Alzheimer's at Massachusetts Hospital and different experts around the country. How long were you compiling information before you said, okay, I'm ready to sit down and write?
Yeah, I do. I have a similar process, it turns out, for each of my books. I front load with about 4 months of research, which begins with reading everything I can and then reaching out and talking to people. And it's great. It turns out this PhD in neuroscience from Harvard, which I thought I was sort of putting on a shelf and felt sort of bad about, it gives me the credentials and the credibility that I need to walk through all the doors I knock on. So I can call the chief of neurology at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and say, I'd like to know how a 50-year-old might be diagnosed with Alzheimer's. What does that conversation sound like? What does it feel like to sit opposite that neurologist? Like, what happens? And he said, come on in. And we walked through that conversation for 2 hours. And I got to shadow neurologists and sit in on neuropsych testing. So I do that for about 4 months, and then I begin writing, and then I fill in as I go. So in the story with Still Alice, there's a scene with a genetic counselor. And I didn't do that up front. I realized I needed to talk to a genetic counselor when that part of the story came into play, and I found one, and I met with her a couple of times.
And Alice started a support group for people suffering from early onset Alzheimer's, and as it turns out, there actually is one, an international support network, so that people can talk about what's happening to them in their 50s.
Yeah, so interestingly, when I was writing the book back, this was around 2004, it was very spotty in terms of there being support groups for people with dementia. Primarily, all of the national network of support groups was for the caregivers. And there was this omission of leaving the people suffering from Alzheimer's out of that, because there was this idea that, like, well, they don't really need it because they were, again, in their mind, thinking of more advanced stages of the disease. But what about the people living with it? And along with the publication of Still Alice, and I think in part the book has helped facilitate this, we're seeing more and more in every state support groups for people with dementia, people in the earlier stages of Alzheimer's who can still, you know, get together and chat about what it feels like to have it.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. This interview with author Lisa Genova is from our archives. We talked with her in 2011. Her debut novel, Still Alice, has since been made into a major motion picture starring Julianne Moore. Moore was nominated for an Oscar for her portrayal of Alice, a college professor diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease. Genova, who holds a PhD in neuroscience from Harvard University, says writer Oliver Sacks helped ignite her interest in science.
It's interesting how you told the story, because it started in 2003, and month by month for 2 years, we watched how this disease progressed and how it changed Alice's life. Is that accurate? And the reason I ask that is we often think of Alzheimer's as the long goodbye.
Yeah, so again, I'm telling the truth under imaginary circumstances, and this is probably the place where I deviated a little bit, and here's how. So the disease does get worse month by month, not day by day, not year by year. You will see changes on a month by month basis. But the disease can progress anywhere from 2 to 20 years, and we physicians have nothing to predict which way it will go for you. They can't say, well, you have these sets of criteria, you're going to progress in 2 years or 20 years. And that's a really difficult thing for families to plan for. How do you plan emotionally and financially for 2 years versus it could be 20 years? So in the interest of not making this a 900-page novel, I chose, and because it's sort of the stakes are higher, I chose 2 years rather than 20. And in fact, one of the patients, the neurologist was managing while I was going in and observing, she was 53 and had just passed away, and she had had it for 2 years. The other thing is I gave Alice a very straight and narrow shot to diagnosis, so that moved the story along quickly. That's probably the biggest place where I deviated from truth. Most people who are under the age of 65 who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's do not find a straight and narrow shot to diagnosis. They spend months and even years thinking, well, maybe it's depression, or maybe it's menopause, or maybe I'm going crazy and I'm just not going to go to the doctor and I'm going to live in denial, because it's not really on people's radar. And of course, no one wants it to be Alzheimer's. So it's usually a pretty convoluted path to diagnosis, especially in the younger folks.
Speaking of paths, you write this book. It's something that you needed to do and you did. But once the book was picked up by a publisher, you were given a contract for 2 additional books. How different was it to write your second book, which was left neglected, knowing that it's already published.
So you'd
think, you already have a bestseller under your belt.
Right. So you'd think, like, well, this is the dream, right? Every writer would love to know that their book is going to be published and they're going to get paid for it. Like, this is such a blessing, right? And it is. But there's a flip side to that, and that is you've now got a deadline and people are watching and waiting. And so with Still Alice, it was a very, you know, I tell my husband, you know, 20 years from now when I've got however many books published and done, and I do an interview and someone says, what was your favorite book to write? I bet it's going to be Still Alice. Because no one was watching.
Right.
And it was a very sort of romantic, creative, I was just learning all the time and pouring everything I was learning into this book. With Left Neglected, I was terrified. And this turns out to be a pretty common experience, I've learned, of writers of their second books which follow a big hit.
And it was an equally big hit, really.
Yeah, so I was really quite scared while I was writing it. Like, what if it's terrible? What if I can only write about Alzheimer's? What if I can't finish it on time? And I was also pregnant with my third child while I was writing it, and I'm not a graceful pregnant woman. So there was all of sort of that going on, being pregnant while trying to write on a deadline. So it was, I was in my own way psychologically quite a bit during the book. But that aside, loved learning about Left Neglect, loved the research phase of that, and then the creative part of writing that story was also a lot of fun.
And we should explain that Left Neglect is about another young woman. The protagonist in this book is Sarah.
Yeah.
She's got a busy, high-powered life. She's a Harvard graduate as well, and she's multitasking as she's driving along. She's talking on the telephone. She takes her eyes off the road for a moment too long and is in an accident that leaves her brain damaged. The right side of her brain is damaged, and so she doesn't even recognize that she has a left side. As it turns out, I'm familiar a little bit with that because my mother had a massive stroke suffers from left neglect.
Yes, most people aren't familiar with it, so that's interesting. It's not very well paid attention to by the clinical community because there isn't a pharmaceutical that treats it. So a lot of people aren't aware of left neglect, which is this very bizarre neurological condition caused by damage to the right side of your brain, in which your brain no longer pays attention to or is aware of anything on the left side of anything, often including the left side of you. So if you have it, your eyes still work, you're not blind, your vision is fine, you actually see everything. And you're not paralyzed. You could move your left arm and leg if only you believed that it belonged to you. So it's this strange condition that I'd heard about over and over again as a neuroscientist and as a student. But everything I heard about it was limited to a doctor's office or a hospital setting. And it was pencil and paper tests. So draw a clock and all the numbers are written on the right-hand side of the circle. And I kept thinking, well, what if they have to be somewhere at 9 o'clock? Like, how does someone who's
function.
Only right? How does someone who's only aware of the right side of everything walk through a whole world only aware of half of it? So that was sort of the question that began that book. And then it became sort of this interesting metaphor. So here's this bizarre, extreme form of inattention where the left side of everything drops away. So you and I would only have makeup on the right side of our face today, and we'd think we're fully done up and looking great. There's this extreme inattention, and then we think that's so strange. Well, what about all the ways that we don't pay attention to things and ignore things and look the other way on things every day and call it normal? So that was sort of the idea behind Sarah. Is these, you know, working mothers today especially, we're doing 5 things at once instead of 1 thing at once, and we're proud of this. We're multitaskers. We can do it all. We're busy, busy, busy. People are on the phones while they're driving the car, not paying attention to the road. Our full attention
is never on one thing.
Yeah, it's spread really so thin.
And I wonder how your work, and because that is the underlying message, really stop and smell the roses, live moment to moment, and really in both of those books, the character has a greater appreciation for life, even though they've lost so much. I'm wondering how you prioritize your own life, because as you said, you have this busy life as an author now.
Yeah.
You've got 3 children, a husband who's an author himself. He's a photographer and has captured New England in photographs in a number of books. How do you make it all work and how do you prioritize it?
Yeah, well, it takes a constant vigilance and, you know, because there are a lot of demands on me, and it's, I think, you know, I'm like most working women and working mothers in particular. It's hard. I tend to try to keep a balance where I have 20 hours a week to write and do work, and the rest belongs to the family and the kids. But then there are there are the situations where I'm asked to travel, and then that all goes up in the air, and I lean a lot on my husband and my parents and his parents and friends who will help out with the childcare. But primarily, when I'm not traveling, my week is that I write in the mornings, and I'm available to all three kids afternoon and evenings. So I try to go to yoga once a day. We live on Cape Cod, so there's, you know, the chance to go take a walk on the beach pretty much, you know, anytime we want. So it sounds like it could be a crazy lifestyle, but when I'm not traveling, it actually is pretty balanced. And I never use my cell phone in the car.
Oh. Learned that lesson from Sarah.
Yes, I did.
You have this this amazing dune shack that overlooks the shoreline, which is this place with no electricity, no plumbing, no diapers, where you go to write. Do you need to be away from it all to be able to concentrate to write?
So, no. So you're referring to, that's actually not our dune shack. It belongs to the Cape Cod National Seashore, and you can apply to have a residency there. And I actually stayed there for, I had it for 2 weeks, but I split it with my husband. So I did 4 days, he did 3 days, I did 4 days, he did 3 days.
He's taking pictures, you're writing.
Exactly. And it was amazing to be away and unplugged and no internet and no diapers. And I got a lot of writing done and I got very deeply relaxed while I was there. But typically now it's not like that. I have a beautiful office at home where I could write, but I tend not to do that.
I go to Starbucks.
It's like I'm in, you know, a wobbly table and a, you know, not a very nice chair. But I'm not tempted to do the laundry, and I'm not tempted to see what's in the refrigerator or play with one of the kids, or, you know, I try to focus for 4 hours and then I'm back in the trenches.
Well, I want to get back for just a second, because it was at this dune shack, which is an amazing place, where you wrote chapters 9, 10, and 11 of Love, Anthony, which is about, I'll let you tell us. Tell us about your book that's coming out in 2013.
Okay, so I'm writing Love, Anthony now, and this is about a boy with severe autism. So he's on the end of the spectrum where he's nonverbal and doesn't like to make eye contact and doesn't like to be touched. And it's about his mother and another woman who will become connected to them in an important way. But the book is about, I tell some of it through his point of view. So it's about giving a voice to this voiceless child. And it's about, how do we love and how do we feel love and express love if the ways that we normally do that are unavailable to you? So if we can't say the words, I love you, and if we can't hug, and if we can't exchange all that magic that happens between eye contact, then how do you express it and feel it? So that's really what the book is about.
And you've really found a niche, kind of following in the footsteps of Oliver Sacks.
Ah, thank you. Yeah, he's the man who mistook his wife for a hat by Oliver Sacks is the book that really ignited my passion for neuroscience to begin with. I knew I was good at math and science, and I loved biology, and I thought I would, you know, be interested in being a scientist someday. And so, I don't know, is it the heart? Is it bones? Is it the kidney? I don't know. And then here I read this book about the brain, and shortly after took a course in physiological psychology, which I think they call it neuroscience 101 now. Mm-hmm. They didn't have neuroscience back then at Bates College. And this was the biology of the brain. This is the biology of how you remember. This is the biology of your moods. This is the biology of your personality and your appetite and desire. And I thought, oh my God, that's fascinating. So thank you for that.
All right. And thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That was a 2011 interview with neuroscientist turned author Lisa Genova. Her debut novel, Still Alice, was made into an Oscar-nominated film starring Julianne Moore. Other books by Genova include Left Neglected and Love, Anthony. To hear more of this interview, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.